You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too.
But who does President Trump mean by Americans? My guests Terry Stiassny and Brian Klass will be discussing his first State of the Union and the day's other top stories, including America's presumed pick for its new man in South Korea is out of the running, should his warnings about North Korea be heeded. Is Italy's government about to become the next victim of the unfashionability of facts? And as a purchaser of second-hand filing cabinets finds themselves in possession of classified Australian cabinet papers, is there any point in governments trying to keep secrets anymore? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the author and journalist Terry Stiassny and Brian Klass, fellow in comparative politics at the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. Welcome both. Now, US President Donald Trump's first State of the Union address was remarkable principally for being relatively unremarkable. He largely read out what was in front of him, didn't blow his own trumpet any more gracelessly than might have been expected, and uttered unctions about the American dream and national unity, which might have been cut and pasted from any number of previous speeches. The American pundit class duly queued up to proclaim this demonstration of elementary competence and civility redemptively presidential, close quotes, though it's still barely lunchtime in Washington, so plenty of time yet for Trump to regress once again to Trump. Brian, speaking as a representative of the American pundit class, why do they do this?
I don't know. I mean, I think there was less of it this year, thankfully, than there was last year. Van Jones, the CNN opinion pundit, was absolutely raked over the coals last year for declaring this the most presidential speech he'd ever seen when Trump addressed Congress last February. And then, you know, within 3 days, Trump had basically fabricated a lie about Obama wiretapping him and then attacked Arnold Schwarzenegger on Twitter about TV ratings. So, you know, this is going to happen again. And it's something where you have these semi-normal glimpses of what the presidency is supposed to be with Trump. And people who have been, you know, careening through the chaos of the last year are clinging on to it. They want something to be normal. They want a president to be a unifying figure. They want somebody who is not reckless and impulsive. And so, you know, when you get these glimmers, people really, really respond. Now, that being said, I think you have to be, you know, somebody who has a very, very, very selective memory to look at the speech last night and think that it's representing anything different. And so we're going to have more of the same with Trump. It's not going to change with the speech. And that's why I think this speech will be forgotten in a week. And the Trump of 2017 will continue to be the Trump of 2018.
Terry, did anything in particular leap out at you, for good or for ill?
Well, as Brian was saying, I mean, yes, we sort of think, OK, this is relative normality resumes. I did go back for reference just to look back at Obama's last State of the Union speech for just sort of comparison purposes. And there was this sort of sudden wave of nostalgia that swept over me. Like, he developed an argument. I mean, yes, there's a lot of, you know, the state of our union is strong, which is it's designed to be a positive, uplifting sort of thing. But yeah, you thought, no, this is kind of what a speech can be. And the thing that really struck me, apart from the issues involved, was the number of human props that he had. And so almost every few minutes, there was a shout out to somebody who was there in the audience, whether it was the boy who'd been placing flags on the graves of veterans, or the North Korean defector, or the parents of the young American student who had died in North Korea. And they were all sort of there for applause and for, you know, sort of these props. And I learned, apparently, you may know this, Brian, that there's a name for these human props at the State of the Union, which is Sputniks. And apparently this is it often happens. And it's after somebody called Larry Sputnik, who had been a hero of a plane crash in 1982. And he was brought in by Reagan to say, and we'd like to welcome Larry Sputnik. And so ever since then, these people who are brought in as, you know, ornamentation have been known as Sputniks. And I think they brought in loads of those, partly to give it that sort of bolstering, because you can't criticise, you know, people who are bereaved parents or a child or a North Korean defector. So everybody's, you know, gives you that sort of sense of a warm feeling.
I did not know they were called Sputniks. That is an excellent, excellent fact. Brian, there was the inevitable hammering of, you know, the unarguably decent economic figures. There is obviously, I suspect, a year into a presidency, an element of Rooster taking credit for the dawn here. But is he entitled to help himself to any of that? Because, of, you know, he might reasonably argue that if the economy was absolutely in the tank, he'd sure as heck be being blamed for it.
Yeah, so I think that with economics, presidents always take too much credit and not enough blame. But the reality is that Trump has taken credit, so that means that it's fair game to question whether that credit is due. And that's where I would push back more than most people on the economy. The economy is, as you say, doing well. Objectively, it's doing well. It is obviously a continuation of the Obama economy. But the thing that never gets really talked about is that we're at the end of a business cycle, and so the economic numbers are slowing down, and Trump is not ever referencing this. Job growth numbers, which he always touts, they're the lowest in the U.S. since they were in 2010. 2017 are the lowest job growth since 2010. The GDP growth for last year was 2.3%. In three of the last 7 years, it was higher. So, you know, I mean, the one thing that Trump can actually claim credit for is the economy in the minds of most people, and still, when you actually scrutinize those numbers, it is middling at best in comparison to the Obama years. And so, you know, yeah, the stock market's going up, consumer confidence is high, but the question then gets begged of, okay, if the GDP growth numbers and the job growth numbers are slowing down, are some of these perception indices just pointing to the fact that we're on the verge of either a bubble, which Trump talked about during the campaign, or the possibility of a downturn? And what happens when Trump loses that card to play, right? How does he govern a society that hates him on everything else if the economy sours? How is his 36% or 38% approval rating going to respond when the stock market inevitably crashes at some point during his next 3 years? And that's the question that I think he has absolutely painted himself into a corner on, because it's the only strategic card he has, and it may go away.
Well, if and when that happens, he will, of course, you know, presumably just blame Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or the Democrats in general, because or the deep state, because that's what he always does. But Terry, he did make, you know, the usual, and they are fairly usual, you know, pleas for bipartisan cooperation, a willingness to extend a hand across the aisle. Were you overwhelmed by the sincerity of those gestures?
No, is the obvious answer. I mean, because you could partly see it in the reaction of the people that he's trying to appeal to, you know, standing cheers from him, from the Republican side, sort of people sitting there in silence or not even being in the room at all from the opposing side. So, yeah, at least, I suppose at least he's using the form of words is something to say. And maybe there are issues, things like infrastructure, for instance, and perhaps he's moving a bit on the immigration issue where those kind of things may possibly be able to be worked out rather than having another government shutdown, you know, the threat of which is obviously still there. But it's hard to see, you know, as far as I've looked, the last couple of days, Trump hasn't started tweeting anything. He's been remarkably quiet and just not been there at all. I think there was one sort of press office style, you know, please watch the State of the Union this evening tweet. And you think, oh, is that a strategy, or has someone just taken his phone away, or what's going on? And I'd also say, as Brian said there, you know, we saw exactly what happens in British politics when you start saying, we've abolished boom and bust. Then along came the biggest bust in the 20th century in 2007, 2008. And then everyone could start saying, well, look, you took credit for getting rid of economic cycles. But that hasn't really happened.
Well, as we discussed or have discussed briefly, President Trump did mention North Korea, principally in the person of the defector Ji Seong-ho, who does appear to be the sort of refugee that Trump approves of. But it is a story, North Korea, on which there has been further movement today. Trump's rumoured nominee for U.S. Ambassador to South Korea, Victor Cha, appears to have been dropped. And this appears to be because Cha wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post disputing the wisdom of military action against North Korea. Cha, who was George W. Bush's top advisor on matters North Korean, pronounced himself specifically against the so-called bloody nose strategy, which is the prospect of an exemplary biffing to signal America's seriousness of intent. Brian, if you are Victor Cha, and if you are potentially the next ambassador to South Korea, or you're hoping to be appointed such by a notoriously thin-skinned president, you don't write that in the Washington Post unless at some level you don't really want the job, do you?
Well, or unless you think that it's essential that this viewpoint comes out because the administration is seriously considering this approach. I think when you take a step back of it, from this story, there's a few things to point out. One is that we are over a year into Trump's presidency and there's no ambassador to South Korea.
That is in itself fairly extraordinary.
Yeah, especially because this is the number one foreign policy threat that the Trump administration is facing. And they're exchanging, you know, tweet threats about nuclear war between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Secondly, there are serious people in the White House who believe that this is the right approach, the bloody nose strategy. In other words, a preemptive military strike of a minor variety, a comparatively minor variety, to send a signal the U.S. is serious. Now, anybody who knows anything about military strategy understands that there is a major risk of escalation if this were to occur. And the escalation could spiral out of control either into the shelling of Seoul or into nuclear conflict. And so playing with this with this risk, I think, is really dangerous. And it's maybe why Victor Cha decided to speak out about it. Now, the fact that this would cause him to be dropped worries me because it does signal that this is a serious consideration the White House has of proceeding with military strikes. I don't think it's imminent because the Olympic Games are about to be held in South Korea, and so there's this glimmer of not bipartisanship, but binational unity with the Olympic cohorts marching together, etc. But Victor Cha was supposed to be the reassuring presence, right? I mean, South Koreans thought that this guy meant that the Trump administration wasn't going to mess this up. Now, I mean, all bets are off about who they'll pick or whether they'll keep that position vacant. And it means that the risk for war is higher than I think it was even a couple weeks ago.
What about you, Terry? Do you make the same inference that the dropping of Cha or Cha's sort of willful sacrifice of his potential appointment is a suggestion that the bloody nose strategy is being seriously contemplated by serious people?
I think it all depends probably a lot on the sequence of events, which we don't absolutely know yet. We don't know whether, as far as we can make out, he was fairly close to being given the job. And there are reports that he's been sort of privately critical of these plans and then decided, well, you know, what the hell, I'll go public. I'll put all of my disagreements out there in the Washington Post for everybody to see. So I don't know whether he'd been told you're not going to have the job and then wrote the article, or whether he'd decided I don't want this job on the terms that it's offered. So I guess a lot of it will depend on that. I think it's obviously a very big problem as concerns a relationship with North and South Korea. It's a bigger problem generally in terms of the ability to actually run a functioning State Department and to fill these ambassadorial posts and particularly to fill foreign policy posts even in Washington, because there are a lot of people that are saying, they don't like the way the administration is going. They're not finding themselves able to fill them with career diplomats. And yes, I mean, it is concerning, but given that, the alternative scenarios which Victor Cha had been setting out in his articles are, fairly straightforward. He's not saying don't have military options at all. He's saying prepare those options, but work with, Japan and South Korea, work with maritime defences, work with the UN and on sanctions, and keep the military option in reserve. And yeah, I would love to know, and no doubt in due course we may know more about what exactly he's been told about what other people within the administration were thinking and planning.
Brian, as Terry points out, Victor Cha is not a... he's not a lightweight where North Korea is concerned. He does believe in standing up to Pyongyang fairly robustly. And as Terry also pointed out, he suggested in the piece tightening sanctions, intercepting ships which may or may not be ferrying illicit supplies to North Korea. Isn't there a danger, though, that all of that might actually have the same effect eventually as taking a military swipe at North Korea?
Well, I don't think so, because that's been the approach for the U.S. for a long time. Now, critics and proponents of Trump's more aggressive strategy will say that obviously this longtime strategy of sort of pressuring North Korea but stopping short of military action has failed, and obviously it has in terms of preventing nuclear proliferation. But at the same time, you know, this is the divide between sort of the consensus establishment view and the much more hawkish, reckless view. So Cha is somebody who, like most people in the foreign policy and national security establishment in Washington, thinks that you should have a very hard line with North Korea, but you shouldn't bomb them. And that's the terms of the debate now. It's not about, like, let's have a soft line on North Korea. It's the idea that we should use all possible diplomatic solutions first, and then after that, if that fails, you have the military option as a possibility. I think the problem is that we have to recognize that the military option will lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. I mean, I think that there is virtually no scenario in which North Korea gets attacked and doesn't respond either by attacking Seoul or by trying to nuke something like Guam or the U.S. mainland, which they've shown that they have the ICBM capability to do so now. So this isn't some game, and I think it's where Trump's inability to understand strategic thinking and long-term foreign policy planning is so immensely dangerous, because you sort of have this whole last year. Trump got away with it to an extent because there wasn't a major foreign policy crisis, not of his own making, that landed in the Oval Office. That's really rare for U.S. presidents to go that long without something massive happening to them. And so I think, there is a serious risk this will happen this year, where either North Korea escalates or something else escalates in the Middle East, et cetera. And at that point, all of this unpreparedness with Trump on foreign policy is really going to become a major, major problem. And there's a huge number of people, myself included, who have been predicting this for a long time. Eventually, we're going to be right, and it's going to be the worst moment to say I told you so, because fundamentally it does matter that the president doesn't understand the world. And that's just, there's a basic problem there. And, we have mountains and mountains of evidence to suggest that that's the case.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Terry Stiassny and Brian Klass. Coming up next, the democratic experiment goes off in the face of yet another pragmatist.
The First Monocle of 2018 is a media special, which takes us into the parallel worlds of music, movies, TV, technology, and, of course, print. We sit down with Takeshi Idezawa, the CEO of Japanese messaging app LINE, and get to know the cast of oddball characters who have helped him and his company conquer Asia. We head to LA for an expo that goes behind the scenes at the studios producing that most enduring and best-loved format in American television, the game show. From The Price is Right to Wheel of Fortune, we discover what lies behind the undying popularity of such programs. Then it's off to Indonesia to meet the team that publishes Compass, the leading Catholic-owned newspaper in a country where over 85% of the population is Muslim. And finally, in the design section, we take a tour around the former Berlin Broadcasting House that's been converted into a slick new arts hub. The Monocle February issue is out now. Get your media fix and pick up your copy today, or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Terry Stiassny and Brian Klass. Now, Italians go to the polls on March 4th, and under normal circumstances, the governing Democratic Party would fancy hanging on to government after a solid 5 years in charge. Under Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and his successor, Paolo Gentiloni, Italy has been stable, or stable-ish. Its economy remains the Eurozone's third largest, and necessary structural reforms have been largely implemented. These, however, are the facts. And facts are, as we know, a depreciating currency in these times. Terry, the Italian election is shaping up to be quite the circus. Berlusconi inexplicably is back, plus assorted other attention-seeking rabble from Five Star, the Northern League, etc. Is the problem now that people, not just in Italy, I want to talk about the world at large, that people expect their politics to be entertaining?
that could be. I think maybe it's just that the voters are, you know, those pesky voters are just completely ungrateful. There's this massive ingratitude, you know, where you can see it in Italy. I think you can probably see it in Germany as well. There's a sort of sense of, well, yeah, you may have run the economy reasonably competently, but yeah, we do. We want a bit more, I don't know, charisma or drama, or also kind of a none of the above feeling. I mean, people sort of saying, yes, we don't want competent, managerial, fairly dull politics. And I think people don't realise until they've lost competent, managerial, fairly dull politics that actually, although it's fairly dull, it does actually work quite well. I mean, I think, we've seen it possibly in the UK that's complicated by the whole Brexit thing. But I'm not quite sure why it is. There was a survey in The Economist recently which said there used to be a kind of correlation between incumbency gave you an advantage historically. If you were there, you're likely to stay there. And they sort of suggested that had kind of gone since the financial crisis. And I don't know whether that was just trust collapsing or the length of the economic crisis, but I'm not quite sure why it is, but voters do seem to think that more of the same is not necessarily a good thing.
Brian, to elaborate on that thought of ungrateful voters, this is just a thing I have wondered. What would happen if the leader of a first world modern democracy just addressed his querulous or her querulous electorate and said, guys, seriously, you are globally and historically the most fortunate people who have ever lived. You are healthy, you are secure, the country is prosperous, clean water comes out of the taps, and so forth. Why don't you all just quit whining? What would actually happen?
Well, I think, unfortunately, that person would probably lose. I mean, that's the problem.
They'd get my vote.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at what Trump's message, how it resonated and how populism resonates, it always talks about this mythical past, this nostalgia for prosperity that is less prosperous than today, right? If only we could go back to the prosperity of the 1970s is not a realistic message, but it's one that resonates, right? I mean, for whatever reason, people think about the good old days, especially in demographics that tend to vote more. I think there's also a broader problem here. I mean, obviously you have all the aspects of misinformation and media and all these things. But one thing that really this story made me think of is economic literacy. And I co-managed a campaign for governor in my home state of Minnesota before I became an academic. And we had this proposal to balance the budget by raising taxes on the top 10% of income earners. When we privately polled that, 40 to 50% of people were opposed to it. And we realized the reason was because 40 to 50% of people thought they were in the top 10%. So when we had the exact same question with an actual figure of how much taxes would increase and who would be actually hit in the top 10%, the popularity of that proposal just soared, right? And so it was this really important sort of lesson that a lot of people, when it comes to campaign messaging and political messaging, can have radically different views depending on how something's packaged. And so I think that's where you need to have this sort of realistic acknowledgement that there is prosperity, but also that it can get better. And that's something, that vision of it getting better is critical to winning.
Terry, you raised the specter a few minutes ago of politicians who were, as you described them, competent, managerial, and dull. And again, to tip my hand, any party put those on a billboard, I would vote for them all day long. That is my favorite politician. Are exactly the competent, managerial, dull people. But how can they actually get through in today's environment? When obviously you get a clown like Trump or Berlusconi, who obviously, because they can say whatever the hell they think they need to get a round of applause, can say that and therefore do get the cut through in an environment, you know, in which people do not have the attention spans that perhaps they might once did. What can the dull, competent, managerial politician do?
I think the only hope that they've got, you know, apart from being competent, managerial, they're going to have to alleviate the dullness slightly, but by actually speaking like a normal human being. If someone could say, yes, I've been a chartered accountant for 10 years before I went into politics, look, I can do this stuff, but I can also speak to you in a way that makes you understand the statistics, in a way that acknowledges that perhaps, okay, yes, we can look at graphs and say GDP is rising, but most people don't feel their standard of living is improving, or most people don't feel that they are getting any benefit from it. So you've got to have the ability to communicate. And I think you know, it's easy to go back and look back in nostalgia at sort of, you know, 90s or 2000s, say, you know, we actually had some of those people and then we seem to have rejected them because, you know, we found them too professional. We found them too, we said, you know, they're just politicians.
This is the thing,
you know,
I don't understand either. Sort of the idea that being a professional politician is a knock against you in the same way that being, you know, a professional pilot or a professional dentist for some reason just isn't. Brian, to return to your own experiences, was your candidate competent, managerial and dull?
He was competent, but he had a way of connecting with people. And he also, you know, had his family business was one that had a very good sort of reputation in Minnesota and then grew into Target, which you may have heard of. So there was also money on our side. And you know, I mean, people liked him. He was an honest politician, and I thought he was very honest. But I think, you know, there's a theory that one of my colleagues has that I'm not quite convinced by, but I will share it with you about this, where he says there are some people who have been sort of screwed by the financial crisis and don't think that their jobs are coming back to, say, rural West Virginia. But they're rational because they'd rather have a show. If they're going to be screwed anyway, they'd rather have politics be fun. And there's, you know, there's sort of like, I can see to an extent.
There's something in that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I can see to an extent, and I've talked to some academics who have done a lot of research in places like rural Wisconsin where they say, yeah, like, I don't think Trump's actually going to help me. But you know what? I like the guy. He's fun to watch. And the jobs aren't coming back anyway, so let's stick it to the establishment. And I think there is some merit to that argument. I don't know how much it explains, but it explains a little bit at least.
Okay, well, finally tonight, listeners, excuse me, who tuned in to Midori House yesterday may recall discussion of the Ferry McFerry face brouhaha gripping Sydney, which I introduced as the stupidest scandal in political history. It has taken Australia less than 24 hours to furnish a contender for the title. Hundreds of Australian classified Australian documents have been published after they were found in two filing cabinets sold at an auction of disused furniture. Terry, am I alone in finding stories like this vaguely heartwarming?
Because I find it wonderfully funny.
Because yeah. they do confirm to me, not that I require further confirmation, that the world is not being secretly governed by shape-shifting lizards from a parallel dimension in a secret underground lair somewhere. It is being governed by people who, being people, do balls things up from time to time.
There are just layers of sort of incompetence and general, you know, haphazardness in this that are fantastic. So firstly, one of the reasons they got rid of the filing cabinet, apparently, is that the person who had the key to the cabinet had left. So they didn't have the key to the cabinet, and probably someone was trying to open it with a butter knife for a little while, and then they just gave up, you know.
If only some sort of system could have been conceived of, like a duplicate key, perhaps.
Perhaps, and, you know, we all think now about cybersecurity and worrying about computers and worrying about everything being lost. These were just physically shipped out somewhere on a sack trolley and taken to a shop. And even better, once they opened up the files and found what was inside, they found a whole load of top secret documents that said Australian eyes only, top secret. What did they talk about? They talked about the previous files that had gone missing. So there's layers on there. So there's a filing cabinet full of files about missing files, which just sort of boggles my mind in a kind of wonderful way.
It is glorious. And I do commend listeners to the ABC's website, because the ABC have published the documents after making, they claim, and I'm sure that's the case, that they have redacted some for national security reasons. But Brian, should governments now operate on the default assumption that everything is going to become public eventually? I mean, it's so much harder now to keep things secret than it was only 20, 30 years ago. I'm reminded of a conversation I had a few years back with a former MI6 officer who was to demonstrate how his own profession had changed, said, you know, circa 1985, if, for example, you wanted to know the top speed of a certain Russian armoured personnel carrier, he said it would take months working on nothing else to find that out. And now any clown with a phone can figure it out in a second.
Yeah, so I think there's something to this. First off, I would like to say that I was very amused by this story, and the thing that it made me think of is the great scene in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when Arthur Dent goes down to the filing cabinet and says, I found the documents in the bottom of a locked filing cabinet stuck in a disused laboratory with a sign on the door saying, beware of the leopard, which seems to be about the same amount of security that the Australian government has gone with. But in terms of secrecy, There was a story this week as well about how secret U.S. bases are being exposed because of Fitbits and Strava apps of soldiers and personnel there. And I think what this really gets to is, okay, governments obviously have the need for secrecy still, but they need to think about how digitized everything has become. And that means that vulnerabilities exist in the stupidest ways. And they really need to devote some resources to thinking about these stupid ways that hackers and others who wish the government ill can gain access to that information. Because if it's a Fitbit or a filing cabinet, there are so many different layers that are not the sort of cloak and dagger stuff of old.
I'm also a big fan, just before we go, Terry, of the document photographed because somebody had it under their arm as they walked in or out of Number 10 or the White House.
That's fantastic. And now also this week, there's been sort of infighting in the Tory party, as ever is. But they're all having these secret WhatsApp groups. And I think now people have realised that all those messages are going to be public. So they write them and say, and therefore we should support our wonderful Prime Minister, Theresa May, who is strong and stable, just knowing that it's going to end up in the papers someday.
That does bring us to the end of today's show. Terry Stiassny and Brian Klass, thanks both for joining us. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan and Henry Ree Sheridan, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephanie Sakia. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.